Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
May the 4th be with you, and welcome to Foment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts to this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitchers, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org, which is going to get a new website soon thanks to a great Kickstarter, I believe.
Yep.
Is that still going? Can anybody tell me? It is still going. Hey, we still, but I think we're close to our goal. If we have not gotten our goal, you can still kick in at kickstarter.com, heritageradionetwork.org. Look it up, find it. We need a new website, and your support is how it helps it get there. But in other news, what's going on today, Mary? In the world, I mean.
In the world?
In New York.
Well, I'm going to start by mentioning another Kickstarter campaign. Our friend Brian Kolbaki is getting his Departed Souls classic and gluten-free beer New Jersey Brewing Company underway. He is almost there, but he's looking for a little more funding to finish the build out. So he also has a Kickstarter. So you go to Kickstarter and search Departed Souls, that's S-O-L-E-S. You can also back him. He is about halfway to his goal right now.
Brian's a fantastic friend, a fantastic brewer. He's been on the show before talking gluten-free beers. He does amazing, amazing work, and we're really excited to see him get his project off the ground.
Yep, so two Kickstarters to go check out is first the Heritage Radio Network to help our not-for-profit internet radio station that we broadcast from alongside a ton of other great hosts and great shows to get us to get a new website rebuild. And then second is Departed Souls, S-O-L-E-S, our friend Brian's Jersey Brewery.
And other things going on in New York City. Brunity is having a second event, Brunity, Brewnity, .com. You can find out more about the event, which is called Suds in Solidarity. It's going to be a homebrew benefit for the East Village. The East Village went through a pretty rough time recently. A fire caused by a gas leak.
Explosion.
Yeah, it was pretty rough. But all 100% of the proceeds will be going to the Mayor's Fund to Advance New York City to aid those affected by the East Village explosion.
And we're going to be serving some homebrew.
I'll be serving a beer, and you're going to serve some
wacky beverages that I'm going to brew. probably a short mead, maybe a flavored cider, some fun stuff like that. Although, actually, I'd like to do a kettle sour for this one, now that I know I can get my chest freezer up to 110 degrees internal temperature.
We don't know what Mary will do, but we know it will be wacky. I'm going to play some bass with John LaPala as well. I believe there'll be some music, and there'll be lots of fun. It is going to be on Sunday, May 17th, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. You can find information about it and get tickets. Tickets are only $25 in advance, $30 at the door. At Brewnity.com, Brewnity.com.
This is going to be a good place to not only support your local community, but also taste some absolutely delicious homebrews and meet some really cool homebrewers.
And if you can't make it, you can join the after party, because we're going to do a single building East 7th Street pub crawl. We call it the Brewmuta Triangle. So we're going to be hanging out at Jimmy's Number 43, Burp Castle, and Standings to support those.
Another event that's coming up that Chris and I are going to be participating in some sort of way or another. Chris has teamed up with Josh Bernstein and Tyson Ho to bring back the Solstice Session at the Arrogant Swine, which is here in Brooklyn, Bushwick neighborhood of Brooklyn, where we are now. It is Saturday, June 20th from 1 to 4, and tickets are $45. They go on sale tomorrow, and
tomorrow
they will sell out.
You can visit Joshua MBernstein.com, not JoshBernstein.com. Those are different people. JoshuaMBernstein.com. This is my favorite event. The second time we're doing it, it's really fun. I love session beers. I love low ABV, but it's And a whole hog roast as well, curated by Tyson Ho.
Amazing stuff. Also, coming up, if you are here in New York City, it is Queen's Beer Week starting this Friday, May 8th. That is Friday, right? I should check my dates before.
Yes, Friday, May 8th. And there's going to be lots of stuff going on in Queens Beer Week all over Queens. I think there's like 100 different venues participating at least. Beers have been made particularly for the event. It's going to be loads of fun. And there is a bar crawl happening on Sunday, put on by our friend Will of Jules. And I forget the specifics on that. Might have to tell you before the break.
Yeah, but we can go. If you want more information about Queens Beer Week, just go to queensbeerweek.com. Once again, that's queensbeerweek.com. You can find information on a whole host of events, as well as Queens Beer Week 2015 Passport and lots more. So hopefully we'll see you out there drinking in Queens starting this Friday, May 8th.
I found it. I told Will I'd do this. May 9th, 1 p.m. at Queens Tavern in Ridgewood. It's a scavenger hunt slash bar crawl. The registration is $5, 2 to 5 people per group, 7 bars, all carrying Queens Breweries prizes. Include gift certificates to Queens Breweries, t-shirts, and glassware. You can find out more about it. Ridgewood Hare and Hound is what it's being called. Ridgewood Beer Society's Hare and Hound. Check it out.
But there's a whole host of other events that look like a lot of fun as well.
Yep, absolutely.
If you can't make that one.
But we digress. Today, we are going to talk with our good friend, Eli Kayer. Eli, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic. We're so excited you can finally make this show today, man. We met you at Cider Days in Franklin County, but people have referred you to us on more than one occasion because we share a vast interest in fermentation, and the diversity is deep. So, Eli,
absolutely.
Tell us about you. You run Urban Farm Fermentary in Portland, Oregon. I mean, Maine.
Portland, Maine. Yeah, right. The original Portland.
The original Portland. The original Portland.
Yeah. So, the Urban Farm Fermentary. We're primarily focusing on a hard cider, kombucha, and mead. Although we really do appreciate and enjoy fermentation of all sorts and types. Primarily wild, fermented, and seasonally available like ingredients.
Cool. So how did you get started?
Bit of a long story, but the short story of that is that I was introduced to beekeeping through a previous business that I owned. I used to own a courier company and had branded it as The Hive, and I was buying honey, and then the beekeeper I was buying the honey from offered to sell me hives. And so I started keeping bees and ended up with a lot of honey the first season and just started making mead. And that was really what introduced me to fermentation in the first place, to be honest.
How long ago was that?
That was in 2002.
Right on.
Basically got me interested in fermentation and ultimately led to the Urban Farm Fermentary and making hard cider and the kombucha and those sorts of things.
And do you sell your mead now?
Just out of our tasting room, actually.
Okay.
I had a company that had bottled mead, when I moved on from that, I really started focusing on hard cider before cider had started to take off, and mead sort of dropped a little bit to the back of the bus, if you will, and cider really started to take off, and then kombucha actually started taking off even more. So, we're doing all of them, but heavily in kombucha and hard cider.
Cool. So, talk a little bit about what your setup at the Urban Farm Fermentary.
The setup is. Well, we're pretty fortunate. I was also in real estate for a little while, and I had found, I knew about this little industrial neighborhood right in the downtown of Portland that was zoned for wineries and breweries, and there really weren't any others around. So I got a little space, basically a single garage bay, about 2,300 square feet, and built out all these different chambers for our various fermentations. And that's kind of how we ran it for about 3 years. We had a little tasting room in the front, a little kitchen behind it, and then on the side was all these different chambers. And then I was pretty fortunate that more spaces in the building became available. And so we just started to grab them as we grew. And so we started in bay number 4 of a 9-bay garage system, and slowly we're able to grab bays 1 through 3 over the next couple of years, and now basically control about half of this building. And it's great because it was a little challenging to have everything in one space. Mm-hmm. If you don't know much about kombucha, or I'm sure maybe your listeners do know a lot about kombucha, but it prefers warm temperatures, and cider and meads prefer cooler temperatures. And so it was always a little funky in the beginning, and grabbing more space allowed us to like temperature control different zones better and keep a little more separation between the different products.
Cool. So how much kombucha are you producing? Let's just start with the kombucha. You're doing traditional open fermented kombucha, I assume.
We are. We're actually, I think, the only winery in the U.S. producing kombucha as an alcoholic beverage, which, you know, it's really not much of an alcoholic beverage. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, it'll come in between 1% and 2%. We're just open fermenting it in giant vats, essentially. Fermenting it's a relatively quick fermentation, a couple weeks, and then we're blending in various teas from ingredients that we're gathering around us, various herbs and fruits and things like that, doing a secondary fermentation in the bottle, and then packaging that. We're probably doing, you know, maybe 500 gallons a week.
That's awesome.
And then how you're bottling, draft, or both?
Both. Primarily bottled. Kombucha draft, because it's an alcoholic beverage, it's a bit of a challenge. We can't sell it in a lot of the traditional venues, such as health food stores, because people can't openly drink alcohol in the streets,
right,
or in the stores. So it's a little tough there. And bars tend to not want to give up a draft line for something that's low alcohol, although they should, because there are people who go to bars that are designated drivers who just maybe don't want to drink alcohol, but they're there with friends. But it's been a bit of a challenge on that front. But the bottled kombucha does really, really well. And the draft is starting to pick up a little bit. Our kombucha is delicious, and people are starting to demand it. So it's starting to take off. But it's been a bit of a struggle on that front. It's kind of the flip for our ciders. Our ciders do well in the bottle, but we tend to do better on draft because it's kind of an easier sell,
right?
Mm-hmm. To the bars and that sort of thing. And actually, the nice part about it, and this has been making some, we've been making some headway with this, is we've been creating these amalgams or these hybrid cider kombuchas, and those have been getting played at bars on draft quite a bit. We're not bottling those yet, and that's been a lot of fun because it's sort of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, sounds awesome. Are you doing a blend with those, or are you doing them individually fermented and then blending?
Individually fermented and then blended, and then a very brief secondary fermentation in the keg or in the bottle. We're not really bottling it commercially, but we do have some experimental bottles in the shop, and it's really interesting. It's really fun.
Cool. So let's go back. You mentioned that you like to use a lot of local ingredients, and one of your kombuchas uses wild blueberries. So
right.
I would like to know how you kind of came up with, you know, why did you decide to use wild blueberries, and kind of what was your process in developing the recipe and sourcing the blueberries?
Yeah, well, I mean, blueberries in Maine, it's kind of a no-brainer. I don't even know how we kind of have to do it. And it's one of those things. Everybody comes to Maine and wants blueberries, and so it really made a ton of sense to try it. There's a couple really large blueberry producers or growers in Maine, and so it's pretty easy to get those. As far as locally sourcing, I would even, you know, blueberries are great, and it's actually, you know, our second best seller, but I get a little more excited about some of the things that you just don't hear about, like sumac, like dogwood bark, like spruce needles, you know, things like that that are all around us and seasonally ripe at different times and really producing some very interesting flavors. A good example also is I actually just picked up about 20 pounds of fresh sugar kelp, and I'm going to be doing a run of that in kombucha next week, actually. And we actually just did a bunch of tests with some ciders, and seaweed cider is something else. It's delicious.
This sounds amazing. We are going to take a very brief break, and we're going to come back. I have lots.
We're getting right
Chris
into
and I have
that.
Lots
we
of questions back, about absolutely. Seaweed cider, so we'll be right back That's with true. More. The National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Ferment About It. We are talking with Eli Kayer of Urban Farm Fermentary in Portland, Maine. Eli, we were just talking about seaweed cider.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell us, what did you? Is it called a sugar kelp? Is that correct?
Well, actually, there's a ton of different types of kelp, all contributing different flavors and salinity, but what I picked up today was sugar kelp.
Okay.
And apparently, it takes a couple days of rotting, if you will, for the sugars to start to actually release.
Maturing.
Yeah, maturing. Right. Right. exactly, maturing. So I got to give it a couple days. We're going to try drying some and seeing how that works, and then we're going to use some fresh and see how it goes. But we've done some experiments with Gulfs, which was super salty and phenomenal, in my opinion. So just fun things to play around with. They're like they're available out there in the wilds of Maine and by the coast of Maine, and it's fun to try it out.
So tell us a little bit about how I'm always interested in hearing people's approach to experimentation. So what do you have specifically, or do you mind sharing what you have specifically in mind as far as using the sugar kelp or kind of your approach?
Well, I mean, the approach is to just try things. I mean, I don't necessarily have anything in mind. I just know that I know these ingredients are available, and I want to try a process, whether it's drying it and trying it like that or using it fresh and just taking notes. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of what I can do is that I can run a 5-gallon batch through my tasting room and get feedback from customers. And so, you know, we learn pretty quickly what works, what doesn't work, and then also just we kind of are mapping it out in a lot of ways. So something that may not work, quote unquote, in a certain way might trigger an idea for adding that in a different process for a different beverage. You know, so it's really what's your end goal? What are you trying to produce? And the more data you have from experimentation, I think the better you can zero in on some of these ideas that you may have. But generally, I just give it a shot and see what happens.
So what, when you're going to do this, the kelp cider, where are you adding the kelp in?
Well, good point. Different processes will create different flavors. What we've done mostly is essentially dry hopped with dried kelp. But what we'll be trying in this next round is actually fermenting the kelp in the primary and seeing how that affects it.
Interesting.
So, Yeah, you know, it's amazing. Like, as an example, and this is a great example, the sumac. So staghorn sumac creates those cones, those red flowery cones, and we tried making a tea out of it, and it was kind of bitter, and it wasn't that great, but it wasn't terrible, so we ran it. And then we thought, well, let's try a sun tea. So we just did the same process, so we just left it out in the sun for a couple of days, and totally changed the end results in a very positive way, you know? And so you never know until you try it, and so I'm not afraid to try, essentially.
Yeah.
and if it doesn't work, you just kind of put it to the side, take a mental note, and move on.
But I think that's a very good kind of suggestion or you know, learning lesson that other people can use as well, is that if one type of experimentation doesn't produce the results, then maybe think about it in a different way, like a cold brewing method or a sun tea method or something like that.
Right. You can use the same ingredient to advantage.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's sort of the goal, is to map it out and get some experience with it and then apply those experiences to products in the future.
Cool. So what have been some of your other favorite seasonal beverages that you've done?
I mean, all the berries are always nice, you know, the strawberries and the raspberries and the blackberries and those sorts of things. You know, some odd things like nettles are really nice. You know, some of the hot peppers we've been getting have been phenomenal. So ghost pepper kombucha is mind-blowing.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're like, you get a little sweet and sour from the booch, and then you get a little heat up front, and all of a sudden it just, like, it doesn't really take you to a crazy level, but it just stays with you for like 10 to 15 minutes, you know? So it's just a nice experience. And then we've been dealing with a lot of foragers this winter and doing lots with conifers, so lots of different types of pine needles, and creating teas from those and blending them in, and those have been very nice. People really seem to enjoy them quite a bit. So, you know, just about anything we can come across, if it's seasonally available. I mean, another great one was dandelion greens. You know, while you're making the tea, it smells like soup. It's weird. It's kind of, you know, it doesn't really seem like it's going to work. And then you blend it into your batch and you let it do the secondary fermentation, and the stuff is magical, you know? So you never know.
Ooh, you're giving me all kinds of ideas, too.
I really appreciate that you encourage your taproom tasters to blend as well on the fly.
Yeah, that's a huge thing that we do, actually, is, you know, we have 12 draft lines. And, you know, we usually have a couple meads on and a handful of ciders and a bunch of kombuchas. And, you know, we encourage people to, you know, purchase a flight of a variety of different things. And we actually provide them with a mixing vessel. And they can develop their own ratios and fill those in the growlers. So you can say, like, I want 20% of this and 30% of that. And, you know, and whatever the combination is. And then you're kind of... You're your own little mixologist. You can create your own custom beverage.
That's awesome. That's relatively unusual for brewers to do that and encourage that.
Yeah, I would agree.
No, I know. Nobody really does it. Yeah. That I know of, you know, so it's good.
So talk about what kind of experience do people have besides, you mentioned you have 12 taps on. You also house other local food producers, correct? And you guys teach classes?
We have in the past. We've done quite a bit. We housed an aquaponics program for a little while, so they were growing fish, and then through the waste stream or the wastewater stream, they were growing basil and various other plants. We had a mushroom grower for a little while. More recently, we've had a few bakeries, an apothecary, and a popsicle company. But recently, a lot of their leases actually came up, and the timing worked out that we were actually growing. So our existing tasting room is getting absorbed into our production space, and we have actually taken over a bunch of the food spaces because everyone was sort of either growing or their leases were up or what have you, and moving our tasting room down into there. So we're actually becoming more of just the fermentary and less of the food hub these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, It's all good, and, you know, everyone seems to be either in a place where they need more space and there just isn't any, so they move on, and it's all working out.
Yeah, that's very cool. And are you still doing classes as well?
We are. We actually, when the company started, for the first 3 years, we did tons of workshops. Because we can't market the health benefits of a lot of what we do, because we're an alcohol producer, and so we really wanted to teach people about the ingredients. And B, where our facility is, even though we're only a mile and a half from the center of Portland, Maine, which is a tiny peninsula, it was still in this little pocket that nobody really went to, so it was a great way to get people to come to us. And then we kind of outgrew our ability to, like, we just didn't have space for it anymore. And for about a year and a half, we really haven't been doing workshops. But we're on the verge now with this, you know, this new expansion, and have dedicated an area for classes, and plan on not only offering classes, but we're going to start doing crop mobs, where we go out and do these foraging workshops, essentially, to gather the ingredients that we'll then bring back and put into batch, essentially. So that's a lot of fun, because we get to teach people about it, and they actually become part of the process,
right,
which is exciting. And so we learn a lot, they learn a lot, and then we end up with some really interesting and tasty beverages at the end of the day. So
that's amazing. Do you still have hives personally?
I don't, although I a friend of mine is bringing her hives back into the fermentary. We had hives for about 3 years, and again, it just got a little too hectic, and we lost a couple of our hives, and we just didn't have the time to put back into it. So I put a hold on it. We're gonna host someone else's hives while we finish building our greenhouse. Our facility was an old transfer station, so there's an abandoned rail line behind us, and so we're building a greenhouse over that, and it's really nice. It could run the entire length of our building if we wanted to, which is about 300 feet. Right now, we probably are going to have about an 80-foot greenhouse in place behind us. And to one side of it, we're going to have the hives that we're hosting for our friend.
That's an amazing part. What are you going to put in the greenhouse?
We're going to grow more of the herbs that we will use in batch. Lots of things that grow quickly, like mints and things like that. We had a 4x6 bed that we've been running for the last couple of years that produced all the mint we needed for our mint kombucha. But we're scaling up, and so we feel like we'd like to, you know, grow more and keep more of it in-house, or as much as we can. I mean, obviously there's plenty of farmers out there that can grow things for us, but it's a nice tool to not only be able to, you know, you save a little bit of money because you're growing it in-house, but you can also show people directly what they're consuming. Like, you know, like, hey, check it out back. Here's the greenhouse. This is what you're sipping on right now. So that's fun.
I want to ask about what kind of containers you're using for your kombucha and your cider to ferment in.
We're primarily fermenting in stainless. We do have some transfer vessels that are, the food grade PVC, essentially, sort of the plastic fermentation conical vessels and that sort of thing. But we've grown fairly organically. It's been the make product, sell product, grow business, and so no real external investment, and so it's been kind of scrappy, you know. So when one of our friends' breweries closed a few years ago, they had 8 of these 300 gallon conical fermenters, and nobody really wanted them, and they work well for open air fermentation for cider and that sort of thing. So we just gobbled them up. They were a good deal at the time, and I've been running with that. And other than that, yeah, primarily just for the booch, just big open stainless vats.
At any given time, how many different fermentations do you have going on?
At any given time, I'm 3 primary types, but then you take it. We make a lot of base product because our ciders are all wild fermented, so it's all just fresh pressed Maine apples, wild mm-hmm. fermented with naturally occurring yeast. I mean, that's how we've been doing it for the last 5 years. And beyond that, it's conditioning. So we're very fortunate. We have a ton of breweries in Portland. Allagash is here. We get a lot of their oak barrels once they're done with them. And our Baby Jimmy is essentially our dry cider conditioned in old Curio barrels, you know. So we do lots of oak conditioning. And then we have quite a few stainless vessels that we can also add other flavors to do for, like, dry hopping ciders or, in-season cranberries or other things like that. But I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does.
And then where can people find your product? So I know you don't have a – you're not
How far is your reach? Are you only in Maine?
No, we are on the whole state of Maine. We are in eastern Massachusetts, so greater Boston north. We're in all of Vermont, although we just launched Vermont at the beginning of this year. And so we're only on draft right now. We actually just rebranded after 5 years. And so we've been waiting for the new packaging to kind of like get dialed in and delivered. And so we'll be launching bottles in Vermont fairly soon. And then we're hopefully going to be in New York by at least the city by summer-ish, maybe late summer-ish.
Excellent. That's exciting.
Yeah, I'm pretty psyched about it.
We're still coming up to visit you, though. That's for
yeah,
sure.
That yeah, you guys are more than welcome anytime.
We just were in the other Portland, so we need to we need to give some love to the main Portland soon.
Yeah. Yep. And it's a little bit, you can drive here if you want, so it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty easy. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
And Eli, thank you so much. Absolutely.
We good luck with the seaweed.
In Maine. Yeah. If you want to know more about Urban Farm Fermentary, you can go to urbanfarmfermentary.com. Eli, you're awesome, man. Very inspiring.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate chatting with you, and hope to see you guys again soon.
You will.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Ferment about it.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.